Hello and welcome to this second part of a special three-part podcast series about one of the most successful medical books ever published, the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. These three podcasts provide an opportunity to meet the people behind the OHCM, whose names you may only have glanced at as you pick up your well-thumbed copy of the book. In Programme 1, we heard how the book came into existence and how it challenged the prevailing culture of medical education. In this second programme, we explore the philosophy behind the book and what part the authors hope it plays in helping students become good doctors. Joining me in this programme once again are Tony Hope and Murray Longmore, the authors who came up with the idea for the handbook in the first place. Murray remains a co-author of the book 8 editions on, but by the time of the 5th edition, Tony had handed over the reins to Ian Wilkinson, who also joins us for this part of the conversation. Ian is currently Reader in Clinical Pharmacology and Fellow of Trinity Hall College, Cambridge, and an Honorary Consultant Physician. We began this second programme with Ian asking Tony a question about collecting material for the book in the early days.
So I'm interested in how your teachers and mentors took to what they'd said in lectures or as asides in clinic or on the ward appearing in print.
There was a big gap between the notes in our pocket and the printed book, and essentially the notes acted as telling us what we needed to have in there, but it wasn't the information. The information then went through a whole lot of us writing something new. Well, I mean, perhaps you're raising how the book was written to some extent. The final text, I don't think, you know, mapped on very clearly to any specific lecture that we would have heard. I mean, clearly there'd be information there that we were told in lectures or on the wards.
I'm interested in that because I remember when I started writing for the book, including one or two observations or quotes that I'd been taught as a student or even picked up while working for consultants as a senior registrar. One of them about alcohol intake and Holt's law of being take what the patient tells you and double it, and that's probably a reflection of what they take.
I've always been keen to try and include these aphorisms, and we all have really. So, and I think it's got more important in some ways in the days or now that we've reached the realm of clinical evidence and evidence-based medicine, which can take over a book too much. And I think it's great to try and distill and record these aphorisms that practitioners utter effortlessly. I was listening to a surgeon speaking about whether you could feel the dorsalis pedis pulse or not. And that's something that I often wonder, well, am I really feeling this pulse or not? And he said to me, if you can't count it, you're not feeling it. Well, that's going to go straight into the next edition.
Let's talk a little bit more about the philosophy behind the book, because I think that does come across, perhaps not in an emergency situation, but if you've spent any time at all with the book, I think that philosophy does begin to emerge from it. And you talked earlier about the macho culture coming down from the consultants, and that was something you wanted to rather push against or to humanise. Was this philosophy of the book something which sort of emerged in the writing, or did you have a very clear idea when you set about it, what kind of view of medicine you wanted to impart?
I think I was inspired by Tony's view of medicine, really, which was that medicine was quite a small topic in the whole realm of human endeavour, and it's something that we could easily master, and that it deserved to be set in the context of human knowledge in general. And that's something that we could stitch into the book, we found quite easily. So I think it was there from the beginning that we wanted to make it an example of that kind of knowledge.
That's interesting what Murray just said, because I remember one of the things, the very first day I met Murray, that I warmed to him was there were 10 of us, and the consultant was asking us why we'd each chosen to do medicine, and all of us were saying these very pious things about doing good and such like, and then came to Murray, and Murray said, I think medicine is the most difficult thing that I can do well. And it was just an answer completely different from everybody else's. But so when Murray says that he thinks medicine's containable, and that he learnt that from me, I actually think that was something that he thought right from the beginning.
Was your view of such things as, you know, how to take a history or how to really listen to the patient, was that something which you already were very clear about in the first edition, or is that something that has evolved over time and over the editions?
I mean, I think it has evolved, but I think it was there from the beginning. I mean, I think in addition to this trying to fight against this macho idea, I think one of the other things that Murray and I, perhaps because of our philosophical backgrounds, shared was a sense that everything is uncertain. So very much against that idea that, I mean, you might not think that looking at the book because it's in a sense so didactic, but I think we very much came with the view that you never quite know what the truth is or what's going to happen. So quite a degree of modesty is important. I think the absurdity of medicine, I mean, Murray in the first edition wrote one of my favourite pages, which essentially sort of said, you as a junior doctor, the following is going to happen. A nurse, the senior nurse, will ask you to put down a nasogastric tube on a patient. This will be a patient who three nurses have already failed to put down the nasogastric tube. Nurses have put down hundreds of nasogastric tubes. You will never have put down one before this. And yet, at the end of all this, at all these experts failing, you're going to be called in to do it. Now, that's clearly rather absurd, rather ridiculous, rather frightening. But the human feeling there is you're going to be put in this position and going to cope, absurd though it is. So something that absurdity of medicine, I think, was also something we wanted.
This brings to mind an important feature that began with the first or second edition, having readers' comments. And we had little cards that people posted to us in the days before they were done online. And I remember one coming in saying that I had to put in a nasogastric tube in exactly these circumstances. And the third line of your rules of how to do it was give them nasogastric tube back to the nurse and ask her to have one more go so that you can see roughly how it's done, and you never know, she might succeed, and sure enough that solved the problem.
Ian, can I bring you in here, because you are in the position of having, I imagine, been first a user of the book and then coming on board later as a co-author. I wondered if you remembered what your own impressions of the book were before you became an author.
Yes, I mean, I think the first copy I owned was the second edition, and it was made clear to us as undergraduate medical students that this was the book that you needed before you went to the clinical school. So I bought the second edition, then I bought the third edition, and then I wrote a little bit for the fourth edition, and then I started writing fully for the fifth edition. So it's quite interesting to go from a book which is seen as the holy grail for medical students and using it to actually starting to influence what's in it. I have to say, I haven't read all the philosophical asides in the book, and that isn't in a way what interested me in the book. What interested me in the book was the cleverness of distilling down lots of information into a page or two and getting the balance right between just dry repetition of fact and the way you present that being continuous in the book to actually making it somewhat interesting. So it's the cleverness of writing, I think, that really interested me in it.
Yeah, it's imparting the information, but still retaining the sort of human sense that it's not just been digested by a machine. It's not just data, it's actually communicating. And also, it's not just the data, but it's telling you what to do with the results of the data, I suppose.
Yeah, or actually saying, well, this might be abnormal, but don't worry. There may be an obvious reason for it being abnormal, or you may not need to do anything. And as I guess I learned early in my clinical career, sometimes sitting on your hands is actually quite difficult to do as a doctor. And you do get the sense in the book at times that it may well be appropriate to sit on your hands. Whereas a lot of other textbooks, you never get that sense. It says do A, B or C. And one of those options is not do nothing.
Yeah, the book seems to me as an outsider to be good on reassurance, either not to overdo it, but also when to seek help. It's quite clear when you shouldn't try to go it alone, I think.
One of the key things that I became aware of writing the book was how small a part knowledge plays in becoming a good doctor. An enormous amount is known about, let's say, angina. And if you were to take the average doctor out of the average clinic, not a cardiologist, and say, how do you treat angina? They don't actually know a huge amount, perhaps just enough to fill a page. If you're looking at all the evidence, you've got pages and pages of stuff that could be written. But the actual jobbing doctor probably doesn't know a huge amount about angina, could just fill up a page nicely. So I thought, if we can distill that and get it in an organized way, that's fine. And then that leaves the job of becoming a doctor more open. You can spend the time that you were plowing through literature to do the central tasks of becoming a doctor, which is really something quite different from gaining knowledge. It's about exercising judgment, when to do things, and as Ian says, when not to do things. And that comes from being on the wards and observing patients in general practice or wherever. And we felt that we could free people from the burden of sifting through endless bits of knowledge so that they could concentrate more on acquiring the difficult skill of judgment.
And of course, as each successive edition arrives, that business of sifting the knowledge must become larger.
Yeah, I think that's a particular challenge for the book over the last 2 or 3 years and going forward, as life's become evidence-based centric, NICE becomes in existence, etc. As Murray said, you're overwhelmed with guidance, some of which is contradictory, some of which is very helpful, some of which isn't very helpful. That, I think, that's a challenge for the book going forward as to how you strike a balance between practical guidance and setting the context of the evidence and trying to cram all the evidence and all the tables and all the calculators into the book.
Does that task sometimes seem almost impossible, or is there always a way?
I guess it can be very daunting at the outset, particularly in an area like cardiovascular medicine where I work, where we are inundated with trial evidence, and there's not a shortage of it. But I think it's a skill to try and distill that down and actually, as Murray has hinted at, to sort of step back and say, well, if I had a patient in front of me, what would I practically do? You know, what is the key important aspects of it?
Can I ask how you think the relationship between the physician and the patient has changed over the decades that the book's been in existence? I mean, I'm not thinking about the empowerment of the patient, the greater access to knowledge that a patient brings to the consulting room.
There has been a considerable empowerment of the patient, and I have found it unnerving at times to be at a patient's bedside in their home and to look up and see on their bookshelf a copy of our book. And that brings me up immediately to try and live up to the ideals that we espouse in the book. I hope some of the ideals are there forever. Other ideals come and go. But also, I hope that the book gives the impression that we don't always live up to our ideals, and that's all right. So long as you can try and do it every so often, you can't live up to your ideals the whole time. So I have this strong impression of looking up and being inspired by the book, almost as if I was its reader, not its writer.
I mean, I think how patients interact with doctors has changed, even in my practice time. I think patients become a lot more questioning. The whole issue of choice has been opened up, and it's become far less sort of paternalistic in, you know, you will do this, this is the right drug to take. And that does present a challenge, as Murray said, because patients may be as knowledgeable as you. They may know more than you. They may come in with Excel spreadsheets of their blood pressure or latest blood results. But I think that the principles that the book tries to get across of how you interact with patients are, etc., it hasn't really changed. All of that's exactly the same.
I was very struck by something you say in the preface about the doctor almost like being on stage. It was like a performance, and you must be aware of it as a performance.
If the patient sees that the doctor is worried, they know they should be frightened. And that's not always the best state to treat a patient in. So if the doctor can smile and be confident and knows his role and can be polite and good at communicating with everybody around, some of the problems just simply go away. Like, you may come across somebody in whom the nurse has found an incredibly high blood pressure, and it may just turn out that you needed to chat about the patient's tomatoes for a while, and the blood pressure will come down, and then we can point out to them that maybe they should grow more tomatoes and take some ways to find an easier way of life, and you can use your relationship with the patient in that way.
I was talking to Murray Longmore, Ian Wilkinson and Tony Hope about the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. To find out more and to order the book, go to blackwell.co.uk. That's all for this second podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for the final programme in the series. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.